If we can't suffer meaningfully in the context of faith, then there's an enormous part of what it means to believe in God and to live life with God that just got pitched. Somehow, and I think we could probably figure out to some degree how, but it would take longer than we're going to take this morning. Somehow, though, in the relatively wealthy, relatively comfortable life we live in the West in the early 21st century, we have gotten the idea that the shape of the goodness of God is the same shape as the things that the prevailing culture identifies as good. That they're sort of a dead match. And so when God is being good is when we have the things that the culture says make life good. And when we don't have the things that the culture says make life good, God is being, well, somewhere on the continuum between bad and absent. But for sure not good. I realize that the combination of the idea of a good God and a difficult circumstance are so awkward that they have a name. That problem has its own theological name. It's just such a big one. So it's a theodicy. It's just a conundrum that's enormous. And I don't want to suggest by what I'm saying that it's a conundrum that we are actually meant to solve. But I think it is a conundrum that we're meant to live into. And that in the living into, many of the things that our souls are hungry for are formed. I know it's not an easy idea, and I don't offer it blithely. All that to say, last week when we talked about the idea of clearing the chairs and making room for the dance of life, making room for these awkward but important dance partners, things like science and religion, things like belief and doubt, things like God's goodness and suffering. Part of what I didn't say then, and I caught it up in the blurb a little bit this week, is that this is a slow dance. That this is the kind of dance, this is not going out to the club and cranking it up and just shaking your booty with whoever happens to be out there. It's a place for that dance too, I expect, as a metaphor and as a literal dance, but this is not that dance. This metaphor is not that dance. This metaphor is a dance you have to get close for. And you have to get close with those awkward partners. This past week at Booth, where I work part of the time, Trevor and Autumn did this slam poetry piece on the dance of being led and feeling like when we ask God to lead us and we don't hear back, it leaves us in a pretty desperate feeling place. And when I heard them do it, I immediately thought about those awkward dance partners, not because of you guys in any embodied sense, but the ideas. And I asked them if they'd come and do that here this week, and they consented not only to come and do it, but to have me kind of, without any pre-prepared questions, pick their minds and hearts about some of the roots of this piece. So, the piece first, and then a little bit of a conversation. You guys, we don't do a lot of this happy clappy stuff here, but it's a way to express something with our bodies that might be in our hearts, so I think we could welcome them that way.
Storm, respond to our pleading. Hear our torn cries, our begging and bleating. We ask you, O God, where are you leading?
Sometimes I don't understand, don't get this chaotic whirlwind we call life. You speak about calming the storm, yet I'm chilled to the bone, moaning and groaning. I've been drenched in water up to my neck for what feels like my whole life. And the storm keeps on raging, drenched, drowned, drowned, and I can't see how you can bring life from this to yourself drowned. I'm always too slow, life's always too fast. I come up gasping for air only to choke on the next breath. Peace, a ubiquitous, idealistic destiny that you speak of so freely. You say it's a table on which even the most undeserving can sup. But you killed your own son, and I wonder, is this your will? Let this too be my cup?
I'm pleading, O Lord, if this is the meaning, would you calm the storm? Respond to our pleading. Hear our torn cries, our begging and bleating. We ask you, O God, where are you leading?
I examine this heavy cup with its bitter drink. The chalice feels like the weight of an ancient palace in gold, yet smushed into a tiny place. Who knew that what you would ask could feel so infinite and intimately twined like vines around a tree trunk? I whisper to you, Lord, take back this humanity that you've given me so benevolently. It feels a curse more than a gift of mortality, like a robbery, a prankster who sees the punchline before it's made clear for the creation to see. And it hurts. You whisper to me to trust you in the wind as you subtly trace lovely leaves that you love to caress. Yet your same gentle voice gets overshadowed by thunderous men who boom and roar like a slamming door. How do I trust this loud, cacophonic chorus whose voice is seemingly restless and whose voice grows hoarse when yours, of course, continues softly, commanding in your whispered, layered love their loud storm to silence, like a dove commands the air to lift her. And yet these lions keep on roaring and ignoring your voice. And I'm left asking the question of, Lord, where are we going? I'm pleading, O Lord, if this is the meaning, would you calm the storm? Respond to our pleading. Hear our torn cries, our begging and bleeding. We ask you, O God, where are you leading? Where are we on this earth? To the one who gave us birth, and has rehearsed and rehearsed her sacred nursery rhymes for us, will we walk the earth listening to her from the womb to the hearse? Let's talk about our mother for a minute. This globe that we've taken a hold of and plundered gold, don't that bubbling crude float bold? It's like she's our hostage, and our avarice insists that we bleed and draw. Bleed and draw. Bleed and draw. She sustains our unsustainable ways, and even when she gets tired, she takes care of us. As we sharpen our techniques and draw deeper, as we stiffen our resolve and plunge further, don't we fear we may cause her a fatal wound? Or at least, if we don't care about her well-being, what about her wrath? Could she not vomit us out once our numbers get too voluminous? Could she not spit us up once her wounds become too numerous? If a mama bear reflects the tenacity of Mama Earth, then would it not be prudent for us to lay out low and repent in the dirt before she brings the hurt to this little viral infestation she calls the human birth? If Mama disowns us, Lord, where are you going to lead us? Because we have no other place but this space we call Earth. These questions are getting crowded in my head.
I'm pleading,
O Lord, if this is the meaning, would you calm the storm? Respond to our pleading. Hear our torn cries, our begging and pleading.
We ask
you, O God, where are you leading?
But the waves keep on crashing, the rain keeps on pouring, each little droplet drip, drip, dropping, forming a colossal wave that is bound to engulf. Have you become so callous to our failings, so content with the chaos, and we cry out in our wailing, your omniscient, omnipotent ear turns a blind eye? Do you not care that we are failing? Tossed and turned, spinning and churning. Has this tumultuous madness, this near-perfect destruction, become so exponentially awesome that the only thing left to observe with morose, grotesque satisfaction is the capsizing and engulfing of the shipwreck called the human nation? Have you abdicated, mutinated? Or our cries simply lost, our voices tossed about by the wind and the rain, our bleating and bleeding, joining the cacophonic chorus to a watery grave.
I'm pleading, O Lord, if this is the meaning, would you calm the storm, respond to our pleading, hear our torn cries, our begging and bleeding. We ask you, O God, where are you leaving?
This water is freezing, it's chilling my toes as the terror within continues to grow.
My shoes sing the blues as the watery hues make love with the leather and the hydro-erosion chews through my soul.
These shin bones are shaking, my resolve waning, this boat like this ship groaning and aching.
The water is rising and my kneecaps are soaked with white caps of doubt that might sink this boat.
This frigid entrapment has now reached my thighs and I wonder, oh Lord, when will you hear my cries?
In this space, the hurrying water greedily clinging to my waist, sharpened indigo claws entrenched firmly in their space. days.
There's no abating. I'm chilled to the core. This boat's surely sinking. We'll never reach shore.
The aquatic elevator has reached my chest. If this is a test, then I've certainly failed.
I'm struggling for air, gasping for breath. My wailing turned to whispers as the icy cold water wraps its grip around my neck.
I'm now almost fully submerged. My head feels the weight of dread as I am a full liquid breath away from joining the dead.
But as my thrashing wanes, I become silent for the first time in a long time, and I hear, in the space between the wind's breath, a still small voice. I am your
light. I'll illumine and guide you.
I am
your shield. I'll protect and overshadow you.
I'm under you.
I'm over you.
I'm beside you.
On your left and on your right. This day I'll be within and without you. Lowly and meek, yet all powerful. I'll be in the heart of each to whom you speak. I'll be in the mouth of each who speaks unto you. I will lead you, and I will be led by you.
One of the things about slam stuff a lot of times is that the words go by pretty fast, and our environment is filled with love and life, and not always the easiest place to catch fast, busy words. So I want to revisit a couple things from the piece for us and ask you about them. And I've got a cheat sheet. I've got the words. The big picture of the piece, for me at least, is this picture of rising water. That's the picture of distress in the piece. Is that the water keeps getting higher and higher. And I'm wondering if I might ask you guys questions that don't have answers. Like I get that art making can be like that. That you don't always know where things come from. It's not some kind of linear, tidy process. But can either of you speak to where that image came from for you? Why that picture?
Well, that picture actually comes from my favorite band, Thrice. They have a water album, and in this one song in particular, throughout it all, they're questioning rhetoric and talking about this idea that we will surely drown if we don't turn around. They're questioning things like, have we ever really known peace? Do we really want to know what's going on? Like socially just being involved and aware of what's happening. And so that's definitely where the image, where I drew that from. But I think every time I listen to it, it's such a potent resonance within me that I just, yeah, had to use it, I think. Had to become a part of it.
So what's the intersection, without speaking to a level of detail that is either, you know, not appropriate or uncomfortable, but what are the sorts of experiences in your own lives that create that sensation of the water's rising and I've got my head tilted back in one nostril, you know, like I'm just so ready to go under.
I guess I can speak to that. My inspiration is a little bit different than Trevor's. Mine came from the Bible. Like
so better.
Way better. but I've really been drawn to the imagery of in the Bible of water and what that represents. In the ancient Near Eastern cultures, many of the creation stories, there's a battle, I guess, to create Earth, but in order to bring life from the chaos, which, let me get this straight. Water represented chaos in the ancient Near Eastern world. And so a lot of the creation narratives, the gods had to battle water or chaos in order for life to come out of that. But in our story, we have a god who hovers over the water and is calm and still, and all he needs to do is speak, and the waters do as they're told, I guess. So I got my imagery from when Christ is in the boat with the disciples, and they're freaking out because this water is raging, and they think they're going to die, and God, Jesus, is sleeping. And at this point, right, they don't really know who Jesus is, and so when he comes up and just speaks and calms the storm, they're like, who the heck is this guy? It's only God can do this. And so for me, I guess it was a contrast between how we do life is often just chaotic and crazy, but God is there in the midst of that and is quiet and silent and still somehow has control even though we can't see it.
And that we have the same question, really, as the disciples in the boat, which is, like, how the hell can you sleep through this, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, what's the big idea here? Yeah. That's a fascinating thing, Autumn, that you're talking about, that collection of creation narratives, those ancient narratives, and how the Hebrew narrative has this divine being in it that predates chaos, that is there before the chaos is observed by anyone. A really important idea in that story. It's also the setup for the conundrum, right? Because the same God who can, as this narrative would have it, speak order into chaos, was there for an indefinite amount of time without doing so in that narrative, right? Just parked, apparently, with the chaos. And then when God is embodied in Jesus in the story that you talked about, God behaves the same way. So why do you think it is, given some of those big, broad stroke kind of pictures? And I know why questions can sound like they're prejudging questions, so with that caveat, why do you think it is that we are so surprised when that's our life experience? When our life experience is that we wrestle with how God and chaos could cohabit life. I told you I'd try to think of some good ones.
Well, it makes me think about what you were talking about last week with regards to the age of certainty. I mean, if we're talking about our social place right now, our kind of social thought, we're coming out of that age where the world, life, was predictable. It was all within our understanding, and we could manipulate and do crazy things like fly airplanes. We could go over the boat. We could, you know, we've been able to conquer quite well the seas, which used to be death. The world was becoming more and more controllable and understood by us. And so when something is understood, when something is defined, then all chaos kind of leaves that, right? And one thing that the sort of postmodernist thought and critique of that certainty and that modernity is that, well, that certainty was actually, or sorry, the chaos was still always there. It was just externalized. It was just pushed out of Western civilization and onto different people groups and onto more more deserted land, basically. And so that chaos has always been there, but I think we're just coming to grasp, I think our big struggle in Western thought is grasping that we've always been in that fragile space of, like, at any moment it could just go. At any moment a storm could come and destroy our cities, or, you know, God forbid, take our families from us. It's always been like that, but we've been able to push
push those dangers away. And so what we're realizing more and more as we listen to people who deconstruct modernity and as they deconstruct certainty, we realize, like, wait, these stories, these ancient stories, and these ideas that they bring up about life being fragile, they've been there from the start. And this was how ancients sorted through it. This was how the ancients sang the blues when the chaos was around. And we can actually draw something deeply profound from joining into that song as well.
Was it you and I, Trev, that had this conversation about the First Nations name for the mountain that we regard as the site of the Frank Slide?
Turtle Mountain?
Yeah. And that the ancient name for that mountain is the mountain that moves, which, of course, the mining community kind of went, not according to our science, it looks really still, and then a big chunk of it slid into the valley.
Yeah, absolutely. It was ignoring the frame of certainty, or ignoring with certainty the frame of a different kind of knowledge, right? That was more primitive and therefore incorrect. I mean, the people of Frank suffered for that because their town got crushed.
What are some of the conundrums of belief that arise from this conversation, these ideas that we're sitting beside one another? The idea that, as you just said, Trevor, that chaos has never been gone. We've just been able to kind of conveniently relocate it out of view and then regard it as gone and shape an entire lens for the understanding of the goodness of God that says God is good when there's no chaos. What are the conundrums of belief that we are left to kind of work with if we're going to re-engage the idea that the presence of a good God and the presence of chaos are not mutually exclusive?
That's a big question. Actually, could you repeat it again?
Yeah, what are the conundrums that we have to wrestle with if we're going to re-engage with the idea that chaos, the presence of chaos and the presence of a good God are not mutually exclusive, that they actually can coexist?
I don't know if we really can, to be honest.
And tell me about that.
I guess, to me, Christianity is bizarre, when you really think about it. Because we have a God who showed his power by dying, which really doesn't make sense. And it works, too, I think. Because life becomes about serving other people and dying for other people. And as we've been talking about with Assyria and all that stuff, it seems like when you go in with power and with might, that causes more chaos than help, I guess, and hope. And so for me, I guess it's just, you have to become okay with uncertainty, I think.
How does that happen?
I don't know. It's a process of life, I guess. For me, I've had a pretty crazy life. I've grown up in foster care, and I'm an orphan, I guess you could say that. And so I've had to live with a lot of uncertainty and a lot of, like, this doesn't make sense. I don't understand why God would do this, but then when I look back on my life, and often I find actually that that's the case, is that when we're in the midst of chaos, we don't understand how God is there or where he is, but when we look back, we can see his hand on our life. So, I don't know. I think it's just a constant struggle.
Mm-hmm. More about engagement than arrival.
Right.
Yeah. Tillman Frerson, some of you remember, somebody who was part of this community for a number of years and is now working as a pilot in the far north. I don't know how many of you get his PDF updates, but he sent one out last week, and one of the things Tillman likes to do in those updates is provide some photographs of his life and his work and his world, you know. And so because he's a pilot, a lot of the photographs in this particular update were aerials. And I don't know how many of you have ever had a chance to be in the north, the far north of our country. It's beautiful, but it's beautiful like a desert. You have to kind of, it's hard to see its beauty when you're standing upright at the normal height of a human. It seems like you either have to lay down and get really close to it, or you have to fly and be up above it. And from those two vantage points, at least for me, it often seems like for the desert in the far north, I can see the grandeur. And some of that's about the way we make sense of things, which is by patterning them. And so Tillman's photographs kind of spoke to me that way again when I saw this last PDF. It was like all these aerials of the north and kind of going, wow, yeah, that's right. This is an awesome, awe-inspiring, grand, formidable landscape. But as I was looking at this one picture in particular of a river valley, a really deep, dramatic river valley, I thought, I bet you if I was trying to get out of that valley, I wouldn't feel like this at all. It would just look like rocks and trees and things that are absolutely, utterly insurmountable. That I'm, for every rock I climb over, there's a whole damn valley full of more rocks, and this is futile. And whatever the drive is in me to keep trying to get out of this valley, I'm starting to wonder about its origin. I'm starting to wonder about its veracity. I'm starting to wonder if maybe trying to win this thing is actually the insanity, and giving up is sanity. It's not an original idea for sure, but it struck me in that moment in a particular way. And there were two things that came to mind out of it that I just want to mention to us briefly, and then we'll provide a little space for response. One is a quote that somebody attached to an email they sent to me this week from Frederick Buechner. The email wasn't from Frederick Buechner. The quote was. I don't really do grammar. This was the quote. Buechner writing in a book called Wishful Thinking. Doing the work you're best at doing and like to do best, hearing great music, having great fun, seeing something very beautiful, weeping at somebody else's tragedy, all these experiences are related to the experience of salvation, because in all of them, two things happen. One, you lose yourself. And two, you find that you are more fully yourself than usual. I saw that, I had this floating around in my head and in my heart, and I thought, these are about the same thing. And the moment where they feel like they're about the same thing for me is close to the end of the piece where the poet gives up and stops thrashing. What if the drive that makes us thrash, that causes us to not give up until it appears that there's no other way forward but to just resign ourselves? What if that same drive has a side to it that's hard for us to see, that is the side that God invites us into when God says, you could give up sooner than that if you choose to? Does that picture make any sense? That we can't help but thrash. We can't help but want to survive, want to live. And to fly in the face of that would be to fly in the face of something so essentially, fundamentally human that it would just be nonsense. And yet, the invitation to life that God issues is, as Autumn has reminded us in this conversation, an invitation to a kind of dying. As Robert Capon likes to say, the only thing that we need to do to know what grace is like is just die. That's all we have to do is just die, and we'll know it. Huh, thanks, Mr. Capon. That sounds easy. That's not easy, because there's this drive in us. What if that drive is so often bent the wrong way by our human experience, bent toward the idea that it's our thrashing that makes the thing our soul is hungry for come to be, rather than our stopping thrashing that can possibly release some of that? What if that idea has some merit?
I think that would be bang on with the name of Israel, which means... So Israel comes from Genesis when Jacob wrestled with God or an angel, you know, scholars debate who it was, but seems like it was God.
He lost.
He lost this wrestle, and then after he had his hip popped out of its socket, and God blessed him and said, "You are blessed, Jacob, and now your name is Israel, because you have wrestled with God and have overcome." But if we're talking about that present sense of Israel, I love the idea of you are wrestling with, thrashing with, bleeding with, crying, weeping, laughing, all of those things that are mentioned in that quote, with God, and are overcoming. That we're in the middle of it, and that we're always in the middle of it whenever we're talking from a present point, because it's not finished yet. And yet when we're in the middle of crucifying, we can yell out. When we get to that end of, when we get exhausted, because it's exhausting to wrestle. It's exhausting to lament. And when you get to that end, there's an element of it is finished, because we recognize it's always been uncertain. And maybe that's the point. Maybe that's a part of what Christ was finishing, is this idea of certainty that we were never meant to live in. That becomes finished when we get to that place and say, "It is well." I mean, that song was written in the context of the writer's family dying, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote this piece, I'm sure, after tumultuous wrestle, "It is well with my soul." And I can't imagine the kind of pain that would go through.
That lost no less in a watery grave, right, as it happens in that story.
Yeah. And so the biblical meaning of the wrestling with, it's all throughout. It's one of the key dynamics of humans and God together, is this. It's there not only in the incarnation. The incarnation is there in a really baffling and amazing way. But it's there in the ark as well, when God says, "I'm not going to the promised land without you guys. I'm going to lead you in your midst." And even when you want to return to Egypt, where you knew where your food was coming from.
You had a good life.
Where you had a great life. Yeah. "I'm going to be with you." That's the most imminent message that continues to show forth in the story of the scripture, is God saying, "I'm with you. And I don't get it, but I think it's one of the most beautiful things I've ever heard."
To those who live in relative comfort this morning, these ideas might be disquieting. To those who live with active trauma and suffering, they may be scant comfort. They may also be the terrain that we have and have always had. Two final things, you guys. One, just a huge thank you for coming to do this. And for being willing to jump in and paddle around in the big questions out loud in the presence of others. That's really important work to do, whether we do it when we gather like this or whether we do it over a cup of coffee or a cold one, you know. We just need to do that. We need to have those conversations. We need to get this stuff out of our heads and into our conversation. And your willingness to do that, which is not a risk-free venture, is something I really appreciate and enjoy very much. Thank you. Thank you. And to leave us with some words from one of the great laments from our sacred text, Ecclesiastes 3, in the midst of a bunch of chapter headings that say basically everything is meaningless in the end, including advancement and money and oppression and toil and friendlessness and anyway, whatever. It's all in there. Right in the middle of that particular collection of little poems of Proverbs is, of course, this piece. And in light of our conversation about the both-and nature of this wrestle, just listen to the... I hesitate to use a word like balance because we tend to misapply that idea. But listen for the poetic balance of the ideas here. And then we'll go on. There is a time for everything. And a season for every activity under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to scatter stones and a time to gather them. A time to embrace and a time to refrain. A time to search and a time to give up. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to mend. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. There is a time for everything and a season for every activity under heaven. Peace. We're going to take a couple of moments to be silent. Something we don't do together very often, but for which there needs to be a time. And musicians will find their places while we do that, and we will break our silence in some songs that probably most of us will know, but which I would invite us to reconsider as we sing them.